Stephen continues his discussion of effectiveness by describing how we can improve the quality of our family and work relationships and create happier and more productive home and work environments by making constant deposits into the emotional bank accounts of others.
Now let's shift for a moment to applying this whole way of thinking to relationships, the relationships we have with each other. I'd like to use a metaphor. I call it the emotional bank account. You know what a financial bank account is. If you were my banker and I were to make many large deposits into your bank account, it would get larger and larger. I could even take withdrawals because of this large reserve capacity. The emotional bank account is like that as well. The emotional bank account describes the amount of trust, the social capital, that's been built up in a relationship. So if I make deposits into the emotional bank account with, say, my spouse or my children over a period of time through courtesy and kindness and keeping my commitments, that would little by little build a reserve capacity with them. Their trust toward me becomes higher and higher. I could even make some mistakes, but that trust level, that emotional reserve, will compensate for it. Unless they're too large and too continuous mistakes, then it would totally drain the emotional bank account. But if I have a high emotional bank account, these small mistakes would be ignored. They wouldn't make me an offender for a word or for the smallest dumb thing that I do, simply because they understand and they care because they know I understand and I care. But on the other hand, if I have cultivated a pattern of what I call emotional bank account withdrawals, such as discourtesy, unkindness, disrespect, cutting you off, overreacting, ignoring you, threatening you, betraying your trust, not fulfilling all my commitments to you, eventually I would get into an overdrawn emotional bank account. In fact, sometimes if you just make one huge mistake or withdrawal that violates the deepest sense of our agreement, in one fell swoop, the whole emotional bank account could be overdrawn, such as violating a basic promise to another. Then the trust level gets very low, and you have no flexibility. It's like walking on minefields. You have to be so careful. You have to be watching your backside, everything that you say and do. You have to measure every word. I mean, it's tension city around the home or at the office. People live in memo haven. I mean, really, many families and organizations are filled with that kind of a climate. Now consider the opposite. How many of you have a relationship with someone that is really strained, where the trust isn't there, where the emotional bank account is overdrawn? Now what happens when you communicate? What happens even when you're very clear in your communication? Still, communication won't work. It won't take. Why? They're always looking for hidden agendas. They're reading between the lines. What's going on here, really? What's happening? How's he manipulating me, or whatever? And if you make a small mistake, that small thing can be blown all out of proportion. Literally, many organizations, even families, are filled with this kind of spirit. It is very interesting. With those people with whom we have continuing relationships, frequent contacts, you have to be constantly making deposits into their emotional bank account, simply because the expectation of a continuing relationship based on integrity and sincerity and kindness and respect is there. Let me share with you a few examples of deposits and withdrawals into the emotional bank accounts. Do you know what the most important and first deposit to make with another person is? It is simply to understand another person from within their frame of reference. Why? Until you understand how other people see a deposit or a withdrawal, you won't know what kind of kindness or courtesy matters to them. You won't know what commitment matters to them. You see, the key to every deposit you make is to make those deposits within their frame of reference, not yours. But it's a common tendency to just simply project your motive onto another, assuming that what would be a deposit with us would be a deposit to them as well. Not so. You see, you're a subjective person, and so are other people. We all live in our own special little world. The way we look outside our body, outside our head, outside our eyes, is very unique. That's why it's so important to first understand what deposits are to other people, and what are the withdrawals, and what are the highest deposits, and what are the highest withdrawals.
One of the deposits that I religiously make is sometime during my week at home, because I work a crazy schedule. I work a week up in the Arctic, and then I come home for a week. During my week off, I've always had a weekend date with my wife, always. We always go somewhere, even if it's just, you know, dinner and a movie, or sometimes we'll drive into Anchorage and see a show. But it's always something that we go out and do together.
One deposit for me is when people do listen to my input.
Some things I do to make deposits to my children is to spend time with them on their homework, to praise them, to compliment them on their homework, to compliment them on little things that they do.
So remember now, the first and most important deposit to another person's emotional bank account is to understand from within their frame of reference what deposits are to them. Another obvious deposit is the making and keeping promises to another. You first know what promises are important to the other. Then you make it. Now remember this, the moment you make a promise to someone, you've created a hope. And the moment you've created a hope, people start to anticipate. They become very open, very vulnerable. So you better come through. But you know, many insecure people make promises very easily because they love the early psychic feeling of other people being happy with them. Other people saying, oh, that's so exciting. We're going to do this. We're going to go on this trip. We're going to go out to dinner. Dad promised me last Saturday that we would go and visit that gym next Saturday. Dad promised me, see? Look at the hope. Look at the anticipation. I mean, look at the vulnerability. See, then when it isn't kept, disillusionment sets in. And if you've broken a lot of promises, people simply won't believe the promises to begin with. Now, when it comes to a really important promise to another person, always count the cost before you make it. You might even qualify what you say with this kind of language. I can't really give a promise. All I can say is, if the situation is favorable in this particular way, I will give it a good try. Now, the person will be a little disappointed initially, but remember, you're not into a popularity contest. You're not into some immediate satisfaction. You're into building trust. Trust is greater in the initial stages than being liked. And generally speaking, when you come through based on trust, you will become beloved. Breaking promises or not even making them, that is also a massive withdrawal because people want the pleasant and marvelous feeling of anticipating some event. In fact, I find with my children that the anticipation of the event is as satisfying as the event itself. So don't get to the point where you don't make promises because you're afraid of not keeping them. No, make them. But make these promises very carefully. Make them sparingly. Particularly when you're dealing with promises that are really important to another, that are really foundational. Another obvious deposit is just simple kindness. When we show our kindness by just being courteous, by being grateful and appreciative, by saying, thank you, please, what's your opinion, can I help you? These are small words, small acts, but in relationships, the small things are the big things. You see, ultimately, these small kindnesses, this gentility, this consideration, this respect, builds huge deposits. Similarly, small discourtesies, small unkindnesses, little forms of disrespect eventually create huge withdrawals from the emotional bank account. Again, in relationships, the little things are the big things. Let's examine another very important deposit and identify both the deposit and the withdrawal. The deposit I would call clarifying expectations. The withdrawal would be having ambiguous expectations or violating expectations. In fact, you will find that the root cause of almost all breakdowns in family life, in organizational work, comes from ambiguous, confusing, or violated expectations. Think about that. You see, here's one of the problems. If the expectations are ambiguous, both parties are acting in good faith based on their own hope and expectation. Then as they act upon that, and they find the other is not fulfilling the expectation, they begin to feel a violation coming in. And if they don't resolve this, come to grips with it, communicate and clarify it, then what happens is it worsens and you get into a negative cycle that feeds upon itself. Sometimes this is called collusion. And as you move from an ambiguous expectation to a violated expectation, now you're moving into major forms of withdrawal from the emotional bank account. And this exactly explains how relationships can be beautiful at the beginning and deteriorate fairly rapidly into one of toleration, into one of fighting and flighting, cold wars, hot wars. And you know what form of expectations become most important? It's how you define roles and goals. That's where you want to make clear what the expectations are. Who has what responsibility, what role? And what are the important goals that we're working on? You know, you've heard people talk like this. I thought that was the important. That's not the real goal. The goal is, I can't believe you're doing that. I thought that was my role. You did? I've been doing that all the time, and you thought, I can't believe. The problem is, most people don't even talk openly with each other, and they just work on the assumption that the other people are violating their expectations. Then the relationship deteriorates. That's why it is so important that you are very clear up front in defining roles and goals so that you have correct mutual understanding and expectation. Who has this particular role? Who has this role? What goals are we working together on? Sometimes it's helpful to even write all this down so that the expectations are very clear, very understandable, not ambiguous at all. And then to set up times where people review how things are going before they deteriorate, so that corrections can be made, so that correct expectations can be reestablished, and you don't get into the accusatory attitude which inevitably follows the feeling of having expectations that have been violated. I'll tell you another extremely important and powerful deposit. I call it being loyal to the absent. That means talking about people when they are absent in a way that you would talk about them as if they were present. The opposite of this is to badmouth, to get into different forms of duplicity and disloyalty. Maybe you've heard the expression, a double-minded man is unstable in all his ways. In other words, when you're trying to walk east and west at the same time, every part of your life will reflect that double-mindedness, such as saying one thing to a person's face and another thing about them to their back. Now, what are we loyal to? Well, we are loyal to principles, first and foremost. And the most central principle is that we are loyal to people who are not present. Now, let's put these things together. Let's say that the two of us sit and talk about, let's say, your husband's mistakes and weaknesses. And you and I are friends. We see each other in some kind of carpool or at work or whatever, and we sit and talk this way. How would your husband feel about that? And how would you feel about it if your husband did this? And furthermore, how might you be talking about me if you and I had a strain in our relationship? Again, you see, if you want to retain those who are present, always be loyal to those who are absent. In other words, be loyal to correct principles about those people. The principle being, talk about them as if they were present. You might even be critical. But the nature of your criticism is responsible and constructive. This causes you to moderate your spirit, to cultivate humility. It affects your tone, your voice, and how much more responsible and careful you are. This is a tough duty deposit because many people get their psychological jollies in talking about other people's weaknesses and confessing their sins. And it seems to unite them with people who agree with them. But in the last analysis, it's a very bad foundation To use the construction expression, it's bad mud. The brick is made of bad mud. All you have to do is stress it, and it itself will break. It's a tremendous assumption to work upon. Always assume that what you're saying about another, they can overhear. I was violating this deposit one time myself when I was complaining to a university president, where I was a visiting professor, about his housing director who'd given us a very bad housing situation, which was contrary to our agreement and the expectation. And I was really cutting into this guy, and his competency in the present said to me, "Stephen, I'm so sorry to hear about this housing situation you're in. You know, the housing director is such a fine, competent person. Why don't we just have him come on over here and we'll solve the problem together?" "Oh, boy," I said inside myself, "I don't want to be involved. I really don't want to talk to him. I just want to talk about him." Present was matter-of-fact to me and very pleasant as he invited the gentleman to come on over to his office to talk about this. But I'll tell you, when I was thinking about it as he was walking across campus, I said to myself, "Oh, what have I got myself into?" Anyway, by the time he arrived at the president's office, I was very humbled and filled with a kind of duplicity. "How are you? Nice to see you." The president could see this duplicity. I mean, 10 minutes before, I was calling him an incompetent. He never carries through with his commitment. And there I'm saying, "How are you?" You see, a double-minded person is unstable all his ways, and I was double-minded. It taught me a very powerful lesson that I never forgot, and my respect for that president went up tenfold. Always be loyal to the absent. Let's explore another extremely important deposit to the emotional bank account. We could call this giving and receiving feedback. The opposite would be the withdrawal. We could call that don't get feedback, don't receive it. Now remember, when you do give feedback, give it in the form of an I message, not a you message, which would be a withdrawal. Let me illustrate. When you're giving feedback, you would say, "My perception is, my feeling is, my concern is," instead of, "You are so inconsiderate. You are so dominating. You are so selfish." Now just sense the tone that comes from an I message, which accurately describes how you see it and how you feel about it, and a you message, which attempts to play God like some kind of a judge of another person's character. To illustrate, one time my wife and I were discussing a selfish pattern we saw in one of our sons. It had been going on for a long period of time, and it was really offending a lot of people, including ourselves. And we could have easily given quick feedback, but it would have come out in terms of you. So I said to myself, "I've really got to pay the price in order to cultivate the ability to share an I message." We were on a family vacation, and I asked him if he wanted to go for a ride around the lake. We went for this very long ride, and we stopped and had drinks out of freshwater streams and so forth, and we were gone for a long period of time, hours. But I'm telling you, the richness of our communication, our relationship, the depth, the laughter, the fun was very, very real. At the end, I said to him, "Son, one of the reasons I wanted to visit with you and the reason why I wanted to take this time to get this great feeling between us is because your mother and I have a real concern we would like to share." Now notice, we were describing ourselves, not him. That's what effective feedback is. It is a description of yourself. The opposite is where you're trying to describe the other. "You are so selfish." See, you're trying to describe the other like you're the ultimate judge of that person. That's the thing that people resent. It offends them deeply. They feel labeled, they feel judged, they're categorized, and thus they become a thing, no longer a person. Instead, I said to him, "Son, would you mind if I shared a concern with you that your mother and I feel?" "Not at all, Dad," and I shared it. I also shared my perception of his true nature as being a selfless and giving person. You know what his immediate response was? "I don't know, I guess I've just been into myself so much, and That's just not been right." He also acknowledged that when we returned to his mother and to others around, and he began a process and a program of really turning around this whole selfish pattern. It was real. It was sincere. It also worked because we were sincere and because we had this great relationship before we attempted to give feedback. But if you take the efficient approach of just getting to the point and giving a you message, it will be ineffective. You see, with people, efficiency is often ineffective because slow is fast and fast is slow. So what if it took 3 hours? We've been living with this problem for months. So you see how important patience, self-control becomes in giving these kinds of deposits. Another powerful deposit is just what we might call patience and persuasion, rather than physical force and coercion. You see, there are so many ways you can influence people. The traditional influence is called, I'll give you this if you'll give me that. It's a kind of fairness principle. You know, I did this for you, now will you do this for me? Another very common approach is just simply to use your power. Whether it be position power, money power, physical power, the use of whatever power, so that you come in with something that is strong and you have the power to make it happen. Now it happens. It's efficient. In the short run, you can usually get your way. The problem is that in the use of that kind of power, that force, that coercion, you have, in a sense, violated a relationship, a person, a trust. And you've also built more dependency in you and in the other on that power. The opposite is patience, softness, gentle persuasion, empathic listening, basic respect. In other words, you're showing great love in every possible way. The cumulative effect of these kinds of qualities at the end of the day have a marvelous effect in relationships and enables you, perhaps at appropriate moments, to give feedback, even to become very strong in the giving of feedback, where you reprove a person sharply. But even in that situation, you immediately show a great deal of respect and kindness afterwards, because down deep in their heart, they know what you think of them. And what you think of them matters much more than some mistake which they're becoming corrected for. Patience and persuasion is an extremely important deposit. Patience is an active verb. It's not some passive quality, but a very dynamic, active quality in which it embodies the essence of faith, hope, and charity. We all violate these things from time to time. That's why we must cultivate another capacity, another kind of deposit, a simple ability to apologize with true sincerity. I'm sorry, I was wrong. I embarrassed you in front of your friends. Please forgive me. I got on an ego trip. That was unkind of me. I apologize. That was a terrible mistake. I wish I hadn't have said that. I apologize. The opposite, of course, would be a withdrawal, to be so prideful and arrogant, to not apologize, but to just continue to defend and justify the behavior, to explain, you know, to cover up in some way. And people can sense that. You're going through some kind of a song and dance, and you're maybe apologizing half-heartedly, like saying, I'll say I'm sorry if you'll say you're sorry. Let's both say it at the same time. Sorry. I said it first. Yeah, but you didn't say it like you meant it. That kind of insincerity and manipulation and superficial apologizing doesn't work, because it isn't truly based upon character, upon deep, sincere integrity. It's better to go all the way and to say, when I embarrass you in front of your friends, that was absolutely wrong of me. I'm going to apologize to your friends as well. I never should have done that. I'm going to work to see that I do not do it again, and if I do, please bring it to my attention, and I'll apologize again. We constantly need to apologize because we constantly make mistakes. Now, sometimes people offend us, and they don't apologize. And this gets to the deeper part of our character. If we can learn to forgive when we have been offended, whether it be intentional or unintentional, that is an extremely powerful deposit. The withdrawal that worsens relationships and undermines your own self-esteem is to hold a grudge and to let it build up inside until it congeals. And then it begins to fester and manifest itself on the surface of your life, and it becomes a fundamentally deep rupturing problem in relationships. You see, it isn't the snake that bites us that does the serious harm. It's chasing that snake that drives the poison to the heart. Far more damage is done in not forgiving than was ever done in the original offense. Now, the interesting thing about this is that if we have been offended, we should take the initiative. You see, most people will not do that. They'll sit and wait for someone else to take the initiative. And the reason why we do that is because our security comes too much from how we're treated. Then people get easily offended, and then they get into prejudices and labels and kidding humor, sarcasm, and cynicism. It all protects them. But what if you could cultivate an internal source of personal security? You wouldn't need these emotional, mental defenses to protect yourself. You could afford to be more open and vulnerable. You could afford to forgive and allow people to change and to start a new day. In fact, to see them differently every day, to give them new chances every day. You don't hold grudges. You don't have to protect and get defensive. All of that is so unhealthy. It undermines the development of our relationships, our families, our organizations. That's why it's so important, in addition to our own kind of apology, so that we can learn to change ourselves, we need to allow other people to also change. We need to constantly forgive others, to let it go, to get the poison out, to forgive and forget.